extraditing him would be tantamount to sending to him to his death. And that's because they're driving him to take his life, because he has endured what no person has had should have to endure. And the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has said that he is being psychologically tortured. His physical health is seriously deteriorated, and they are killing him. If he dies, it's because they are killing him. They are torturing him to death.
Stella Maris, I want to thank you so much for being with us, the partner of the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in Glasgow, as part of her campaign to free Julian and to show how WikiLeaks revealed evidence of corporations and states undermining the goals of prior climate summits. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
To listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a web and new media coordinator. Our web and new media coordinator is responsible for KBOO's website and social media accounts. Applicants should have experience administering a CMS such as Drupal and experience administering a MySQL database, including backups and queries. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due by November 17th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. COVID-19 daily cases fall below 1,000 in Oregon. The Dalles City Council votes to give Google an undisclosed amount of water to cool their data centers. And a judge directs the City of Portland and the DOJ to go back to mediation to work out differences of body-worn camera policies and other reforms. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. A federal judge on Tuesday directed the City of Portland and the U.S. Department of Justice to go back to mediation to work out differences on body-worn camera policies and other reforms. Portland and the DOJ had reached a tentative agreement on changes, including equipping officers with body cameras to meet the demands of a 2014 settlement designed to curb police use of excessive force. The settlement followed a federal investigation that found Portland officers used excessive force against people with mental illness. It called for widespread changes to use of force and taser policies, training, supervision, and oversight, a restructuring of police crisis intervention services, and quicker investigations into alleged police misconduct. The Justice Department in April issued a formal notice to the city that it had failed to meet key reforms under the settlement, citing inappropriate police use and management of force during last year's racial justice protests, inadequate training, and subpar supervision by higher-ups. The city had agreed to most of the remedies sought by federal lawyers. The judge's direction means all involved must go back to mediation one more time to try to bridge differences regarding a policy to govern the use of police body-worn cameras and whether sergeants, as well as higher-ranking officers, should also be held accountable for improper use of force during protests last year. Community groups who have been parties to the settlement, including the Albina Ministerial Alliance's Coalition for Justice and Police Reform and the Mental Health Alliance, say the city has not gone far enough. The groups are concerned that the latest agreement moving forward with a body camera program does not include a written policy on how the cameras will be used. They want it spelled out that the police bureau will bar officers from previewing body camera footage before giving a statement to investigators after using deadly force. The Portland Police Association, city attorney, and Justice Department lawyers had signed the tentative agreement. Top officials from the DOJ had given their approval, and it was expected to go before the city council for a vote on December 2nd. The judge has urged that the timeline be scrapped. Tomorrow, the Portland City Council will consider and potentially vote on where to spend its budget surplus. The City Council has an estimated $62 million in surplus funds it needs to distribute. It's common for the city to only see around $5 million in excess funds during this fall process. The spending increases are being funded by unexpectedly large city and county surpluses generated by high business license tax collections. Because of city policy, the council is only allowed to use half of those surplus dollars on city programs, while the rest is set aside for infrastructure costs. This leaves the council with about $31 million in one-time funds to spend on city programs. Last week, the city announced it would be setting aside nearly $19 million of those dollars for services and programs to address houselessness as part of a joint investment with Multnomah County. Mayor Ted Wheeler and Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri have proposed a spending plan that creates new shelters, increases outreach teams, and cleans up trash. Wheeler also proposed spending $7 million in city funds to immediately rehire 25 retired Portland police officers, increase recruiting efforts to hire 200 more sworn officers and 100 unarmed safety specialists in the future, and expand the Portland Street Response Program citywide. Wheeler has said that he has the support of enough city council members to pass his public safety proposal in a 3-2 vote. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has raised concerns about the proposal, including wanting more time and public input. Hardesty said she is open to rehiring retired police officers, but that her office will work on amendments to make sure the city does not bring back someone who left in lieu of a use of force investigation or who has complaints of discriminatory behavior. The City Council will take public testimony and hear any amendments to the budget proposal tomorrow, Wednesday, November 10th. The Council could decide to vote that same day. Otherwise, the budget goes to a second reading the following Wednesday. COVID-19 daily cases have fallen below 1,000 in Oregon, but hospitalizations are rising in neighboring California. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Oregon is averaging fewer than 1,000 daily COVID cases for the first time since August. Oregon averaged 949 cases per day over the last week, with 58 deaths. The state recorded 8 consecutive weeks of declines, and then a rise at the end of October. The latest numbers reflect a 16% downtrend, the largest since June. That was when Governor Brown lifted a number of COVID-19 related safeguards. Testing positivity rates are also declining, falling below 7%. Meanwhile, COVID-19-related hospitalizations have risen significantly in parts of California. Experts worry this is a predictor of a COVID surge as the winter holidays approach. California locales with low vaccination rates, like San Bernardino County, have seen greater than 27% rises in hospitalizations. Many California hospitals are at 110 to 130% of normal capacity, and some are postponing scheduled surgeries. Demands for boosters are falling below expected rates in California. Experts say seniors who were vaccinated last winter and did not get a booster likely have waning immunity. Many younger patients who are being hospitalized in California never got vaccinated to begin with. Recent data from the CDC suggests those who catch COVID and who do not also get vaccinated are 5 times more likely to get a new infection versus fully vaccinated patients. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Health officials are trying to overcome politics in a new phase of the pandemic as the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine is being recommended by the CDC for kids ages 5 to 11. Tramell Gomes has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Health officials are optimistic that broad immunity against COVID-19 can be achieved for children now that the CDC has recommended a pediatric version of Pfizer's vaccine for kids 5 to 11 years old. COVID infection rates are largely falling in the U.S., but that has been a challenge due to vaccine hesitancy. Tiffany Helberg with Community Health of South Florida says reaching out in hard-to-reach communities and trying to gain trust is something they've been doing for more than 50 years. But things have been different with COVID.
Of course, this is a greater challenge now as politics has been injected into this medical fight over the pandemic. But nonetheless, we have launched a full court press to try and educate the community from the beginning.
Florida's Republican leaders have been fighting against vaccine and mask mandates. Governor Ron DeSantis has called a special legislative session to block businesses or school districts from implementing either. Some studies link a rise in vaccine hesitancy to politicized debate around the pandemic. Dr. Ron Yee with the National Association of Community Health Centers says that's why community health centers are so important. They have been working to build trusted relationships about COVID with people in their areas so they can get them accurate information and encourage them to get vaccinated.
Not everybody's going to step up and get a vaccine right away. There'll be some, like we saw with the adults, that immediately come in. There's going to be some that come in later. There's going to be some on the fence, and there's going to be some that start with, no, I don't want to get this.
Helberg says since the inception, they've been tackling organic vaccine hesitancy and the ones revved up by politics through a robust community outreach plan to all of their South Florida locations.
We also are very culturally sensitive. All of our employees are trained in cultural sensitivity. So we understand that different cultures come with different beliefs about the vaccine. And so we try and approach it different ways depending on who we're talking to.
Community health centers have been caring for those living in poverty and other hard-to-reach populations since the mid-1960s. To date, the centers have completed nearly 16 million vaccines. This is Tramel Gomes.
The Dal City Council has approved an agreement to deliver an undisclosed amount of groundwater to Google, which plans to build new data centers in the city. Google employs about 200 people in the Dalles. The council's unanimous vote means the tech giant has secured another key piece of its plan to expand its operations in the Columbia River Gorge. The Dalles, along with Wasco County, approved a separate agreement in October to significantly reduce property taxes on new Google developments. The deal could boost property tax collections by several million dollars a year for the city, but still figures to save Google tens of millions of dollars over the 15-year lifespan of the tax breaks. Google has plans to build up to two new data centers on the site of a former aluminum smelter in the Dalles Industrial District. The company owns water rights associated with the site. Under the agreement approved Monday, Google will transfer those water rights to the city of the Dalles. Google will then pay to access the water it needs at the new facilities via the city utility. City officials have refused to reveal how much water Google is requesting for the proposed data centers, which has been the primary frustration for area residents. The company considers water use at its facilities a proprietary trade secret and forbids disclosure. The Wasco County District Attorney recently determined water use at the Google facilities is public record and ordered the city to provide those records to the Oregonian, which had requested them. The Dalles filed a lawsuit against the newspaper in state court to challenge the DA's findings. City officials have said in previous meetings that the amount of water Google is requesting for the new facilities is safely within the sustainable withdrawal limits of the Dalles groundwater aquifer. Google says it needs more water to cool its data centers, but neither the company nor the city will say how much more, only that the Dalles cannot meet Google's needs without expanding its water system. The deal calls for Google to pay for the upgrade. The Dalles says Google would use just a portion of the additional water capacity, giving the city more water for its residents and industry. However, amid a prolonged drought, residents and farmers have expressed worries that the deal might strain the city's water supply rather than boost it. Charter schools in the U.S. present both options and problems. Critics of charter schools say they are draining funding from school districts, while proponents say they are providing much-needed options for traditional education. With more on the story, it's Faven Garazgahar with the Racial Reckoning Project.
According to St. Paul school officials, last year close to 40% of the city's school-aged children were not attending schools in the district. Instead, families are increasingly enrolling their kids in charter schools. Minneapolis public schools have been seeing a similar decline in enrollment. Myron Orfield is the director of the Institute of Metropolitan Opportunity at the University of Minnesota. He says proponents of charter schools promise they'd be more racially integrated than traditional public schools and outperform them, but they failed on both counts.
The charter schools do worse than the public schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so charter schools have entered the system. They've taken a huge number of resources away from the city schools. They really kind of crippled the city schools' finances.
Orfield says charter schools have accelerated racial segregation, which often leads to gaps in funding and other inequities. However, for marginalized communities, charter schools can prove helpful. Dr. Samuel Yigza is executive director at Higher Ground Academy, a K-12 charter school in St. Paul known for its predominantly East African student population and diverse staff. He says the school has built relationships with the community, which has attracted more families.
They are making a choice based on what they see. They see their neighbor's son or daughter going to a good school and finishing, graduating, and then having a job. And this is something that the parents value. Even if we say, oh, they went to that school because there is someone that looks like them, there has to be a good reason to keep them there.
Yigza says while traditional public schools are excellent, they do not work for some students, which is why they need options like Higher Ground. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Faven Garazgahar.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center. Online at racialreckoningmn.org.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the threat posed by the U.S.'s stockpile of intercontinental ballistic missiles with David Rosenberg, followed by an interview with Climate Central's Andrew Pershing about what's going on at COP26. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 54 degrees. Today in history, in 1970, the Supreme Court refuses to hear a challenge by the state of Massachusetts regarding the constitutionality of the Vietnam War. By a 6-3 vote, the justices rejected the effort of the state to bring a suit in federal court in defense of Massachusetts residents, claiming protection under a state law that allowed them to refuse military service in an undeclared war. The quote of the day is from American professional tennis player Arthur Ashe, who was the only black man to win the singles title at Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and the Australian Open. Ashe said, quote, "True heroism is remarkably sober, very undramatic. It is not the urge to surpass all others at whatever cost, but the urge to serve others at whatever cost." Senator Joe Manchin faces blowback over the Build Back Better bill. More than half of Americans don't want Biden or Trump to run in 2024, and Republicans try to block payments for separated migrant families. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're talking about people making ends meet in this country. It's more than a disgrace. It is just a tragedy.
Economist Jeffrey Sachs in West Virginia Monday criticized Senator Joe Manchin's pushback against the Build Back Better plan's $1.75 trillion price tag. Sachs noted it amounts to less than 1% of the nation's income.
Can't afford that, Senator? Well, yeah, if you have to give everything to the rich so you don't take a penny from them, then you can't afford it.
Meanwhile, President Biden's approval rating dropped to a new low of 38%. New polling reveals nearly two-thirds of Americans don't want Biden to run for a second term, and 58% oppose Trump running in 2024. With the falling poll numbers and the upset in Virginia's gubernatorial race, Republicans are optimistic about their odds of flipping other governors' offices in 2022. The GOP currently holds 27 governors' offices. Democrats have 23, and 36 are up for grabs next year, including Florida, where incumbent Republican Ron DeSantis announced he'll run again. Senate Republicans introduced an amendment to the 2022 Defense Authorization Bill to block $450,000 settlement payments to migrant families separated at the border. Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma.
The majority of American people, I don't even have to ask them if they think that people that had illegally crossed the border should get $450,000 and families of those who had died in the line of duty serving in our military should get $100,000. I don't even have to ask that question. I already know where they are.
The payments would come from the DOJ to resolve lawsuits alleging forced separation subjected children to psychological trauma. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot issued six new subpoenas Monday, including former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and John Eastman, an attorney behind Trump's strategy to overturn the election results.
Nothing is more important than our children's health. It's up to us to keep them safe.
In Virginia, First Lady Jill Biden and U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy kicked off a nationwide effort to encourage COVID-19 vaccinations for children ages 5 to 11.
It's about a third of the dose of that adults get. But it also went through clinical trials specific to the 5 through 11 age group.
The CDC recommended the use of the pediatric Pfizer vaccine on November 2nd. At the COP26 summit, former President Barack Obama encouraged young people to apply political pressure in the climate fight, but warned they need to accept compromises.
In a lot of our countries, there are people who are afraid of change. And even if they're not full climate deniers, they're worried that the transition is not going to benefit them, and it might even hurt them.
Obama also criticized China and Russia's leaders for not doing their part to reduce emissions. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
A search for graves is underway at a former residential school in Saskatchewan, Canada, and tribal firefighters use cultural burn methods practiced by their ancestors. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A search is underway for unmarked graves at the site of another former residential school in Saskatchewan. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, more than 55 acres of land will be searched using ground-penetrating radar.
The Capel Indian Residential School, run by the Catholic Church, operated from 1884 to the late 1900s. It was one of the last residential schools to close in Canada. The search began this week of 55 acres, and the entire process could take up to 3 years. Michael Starr is the chief of the nearby Star Blanket Cree Nation. He believes some remains will be found.
We are hoping to find our relatives that didn't make it home.
Survivors of the school talked about their experiences during a community roundtable. One talked about a fellow classmate who told him he was taken by priests and put in an underground hidden cell. Many want answers about what happened to children who never returned home. Others want more. Bobby Cameron is the chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations. He says the Canadian government should charge those still alive who perpetrated the crimes at the residential schools.
If I was 90 years old today, an Indian man, and I killed a white boy several decades ago, and it was just found in the year 2021 that I committed this horrific crime, without question and swiftly, I'd be thrown into jail, and I'd be put away for life and die in there.
The Capel School, 50 miles northeast of Regina, went by several names. It was destroyed and rebuilt more than once by fire. About 150,000 Native children were forced to attend the schools across Canada from the late 1800s to the late 1900s. Thousands were abused and stripped of their language and culture. Many died. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Recently, near Eugene, Oregon, 15 Native American firefighter trainees carried out a prescribed burn. That's a deliberate and controlled fire, often called a cultural burn by Native people, as it follows methods practiced by their ancestors. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the practice is gaining serious attention.
One thing you're watching for is like how hard it is.
On the Andrew Reasoner Wildlife Preserve, crews use drip torches to ignite 8 acres worth of brush as water engines stand at the ready. 20th century firefighting by federal and state agencies focused on immediate wildfire suppression, not setting fires to reduce slash and vegetation. But early natives set these good fires to prevent larger ones and to rejuvenate certain plants.
For instance, the women that used to pick the huckleberries, which we call ewum, they would burn, you know, every 4 years into the huckleberry stands to bring back more ewum.
Derek Kimball is a Klamath Modoc tribal member with a nonprofit called Mukluxgakini, meaning place of the people. He brought several youth along to share indigenous fire practices, which were suppressed for generations after colonization.
So with the loss of the knowledge through history, that's played a big part in what we're seeing today with the devastation of the mega fires and the dying of the forest.
After more than a century of wildfire suppression, many incidents have been catastrophic in size and intensity. Accumulated slash and vegetation, combined with a hotter and drier climate, have sparked monstrous fires, including this year's Dixie Fire in California. But more and more forestry agencies are exploring controlled burns as a way to limit the size and spread of future wildfires. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull near Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Women account for less than a third of workers in the solar industry. Now, a national nonprofit is training women for careers in solar. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A growing number of women work in the solar industry, but they still account for less than a third of solar jobs. To prepare more women for employment in the industry, the national nonprofit Grid Alternatives runs free training programs, and before the pandemic, partnered on annual women-only solar builds. In 2019, almost 100 women installed a large solar array on a mixed-income apartment building in Denver.
Some had extensive experience. Some women had no experience whatsoever, and it created this safe space of you can ask questions and not be judged, or you're learning from another woman how to do this.
That's Adrienne Dorsey of Grid Alternatives Colorado, the chapter that hosted the build. President Biden has set a goal for the U.S. to be powered by 100% clean electricity within 15 years. Meeting that target would require hundreds of thousands more people to join the solar workforce. So Dorsey says creating inclusive spaces to learn and train can help ensure that the growing industry is open to everyone.
Creating pathways for everybody to be a part of it is what's necessary to actually happen if we're going to hit these goals and really effectively mitigate climate change.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Yasmin Kovanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Faven Garazgahar, Tramel Gomes, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland is joined by guests Jacqueline Keeler and David Lewis to talk about stolen native land at Willamette Falls. At 9, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, featuring art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Dirtbag. Host Glenn Anderson is joined by guest Jim Gilbert to discuss the season of Persimmon and 50 Ways to Love Your Leaves. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on the threat posed by the U.S.'s stockpile of intercontinental ballistic missiles with David Rosenberg.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Intercontinental ballistic missiles are a vital part of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. According to some critics of U.S. policy, they pose a major threat to the survival of the planet. William Hartung is the director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy and the author of Inside the ICBM Lobby. KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg asked him whether ICBMs were something people even thought about, or whether they were accepted as just a normal part of reality.
Yes, I think the fact that we have intercontinental ballistic missiles, 400 of them ready to be launched at any moment, is either unknown to people in the United States or just accepted as part of the background, not something to be concerned about or discussed.
What about the lobby for these ICBMs? Is it any different than, say, what we would think of as the military-industrial complex or a defense lobby?
Well, there's a lobby for ICBMs, which is kind of a subgroup of the military-industrial complex, but it's particularly dogged. There's senators from the states that have ICBM bases, like Wyoming, Montana, and North Dakota, and Utah, where a lot of the development work is done on ICBMs, and they've blocked virtually every attempt to either